It is Monday, July the 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, is the Islamic State changing its methods?
The attacks in Baghdad, which have been part of years-long patterns but have really intensified over the last 12 months, fit that pattern of insurgency and terrorist methods. The attacks around the world, of course, are terrorist attacks, but it also speaks to a global insurgency.
Also ahead, China delivering military aid to Afghanistan, the refugees in Rwanda, and it is America's 240th birthday. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. In developing news, a suicide bomber was killed, two other people wounded, and a blast outside the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia's second-largest city of Jeddah earlier today. The attacker parked his car outside a mosque opposite the consulate, and shortly afterwards it was detonated. The Islamic State has carried out a series of bombings and shooting attacks in Saudi Arabia since late 2014 that have killed scores of people, mostly members of the Shiite Muslim minority and security services. So far, there's no claim of responsibility for this particular attack today. Also, a suicide truck bomb struck in downtown Baghdad, killing 115, wounding nearly 200 others who were out shopping and celebrating ahead of the holiday marking the end of Ramadan. That attack, claimed by the Islamic State, was the deadliest in months in the Iraqi capital and came despite a series of recent gains against the extremists, including the capture of the city of Fallujah. VOA's Victor Beede asked Deakin University analyst Greg Barton about the capture of Fallujah, which many thought would put an end to IS assaults on Baghdad.
Look, the capture of Fallujah was important in itself, and it was hoped that it would put the squeeze on Islamic State logistically in terms of preparing the vehicle-based IEDs that are being sent into Baghdad. But clearly we've seen a shift in tactic and strategy with IS. They're moving towards insurgent methods when in the past they had settled into protecting cities like Fallujah through conventional military methods. And it seems that they still have the resources to send suicide missions into Baghdad, even with a loss of Fallujah. And you'd have to assume that it's going to take a long time to completely remove their presence from the countryside. They may no longer be in an obvious location in Fallujah, but clearly they've got people around Anbar province and all around Baghdad who are able to operate and send these missions into Baghdad. So in a sense, no one thought Fallujah would be an instant fix, but I think we're now beginning to count the true cost of taking back Fallujah, because it's not just the weekend attacks in Baghdad, but I think we can link in the attacks in Dhaka, Bangladesh, Istanbul, Turkey, and indeed Orlando, Florida, as being all part of a concerted effort by Islamic State to show itself that it continues to be potent even after it's lost the first city it took in Iraq.
Well, I want to shift focus now to Dhaka, where the home minister on Sunday said Friday's attack at a Dhaka restaurant by these seven militants, one of whom survived, made no apparent demands, but he rejected the idea that Islamic State was claiming responsibility, saying they were domestically inspired young men. What do you make of that?
Look, it sounds like a dangerous degree of delusion and or denial by the Bangladeshi government. To be fair to them, Islamic State's only been claiming a presence there since the first attack on an Italian aid worker in September 2015, whereas its al-Qaeda affiliate, Ansar al-Islam, has been active there for years. And for years, most of the attacks by local Bangladeshis, by this al-Qaeda affiliate, were against liberal Muslims. But since September last year, we've seen targeted attacks against non-Muslims by groups claiming to be linked to Islamic State. And the whole thing about the way Islamic State works around the world is that the international attacks are generally carried out by people who are citizens of their own countries and have grown up in their own, often the very neighborhoods that they attack. So either the Bangladeshis are struggling to come to terms with this new dynamic, or for whatever political reason, they don't yet want to acknowledge it. But it would seem that we've reached an inflection point with the organized mass attack in the Dhaka bakery, in that given that one person has been arrested, one of the attackers survived,
the links with Islamic State, if that's what's indeed there, are going to become very clear, or at least the situation will become very clear. It's not an either-or case that because you have local, in this case, middle-class students who have become radicalized, that excludes international networks. That's not the way Islamic State works. It reaches into local networks and uses those people.
Greg, we've heard officials and analysts tell us that Islamic State is on the defensive, but among the bombing targets that you mentioned earlier, is Islamic State tactic changing at all? Is its strategy changing?
Well, on the ground in Iraq, Syria, it seems that they're falling back on the insurgent methods that took them into power. Once they'd taken Mosul, of course, they'd earlier taken Fallujah and Raqqa, they have been holding those cities by means of conventional force. But in some ways, the collapse of their force in Fallujah was suspiciously quick. It seems like they fully intended to pull back quickly, and they now seem to be falling back on insurgent activity in that same Anbar province. In other words, they decided not to defend what in the end would probably be an indefensible stronghold, but rather to pull back on insurgency. So the attacks in Baghdad, which has been part of years-long patterns that have really intensified over the last 12 months, fit that pattern of insurgency and terrorist methods. The attacks around the world, of course, are terrorist attacks, but it also speaks to a global insurgency. Now, it reminds us we're dealing with a hybrid organization in Islamic State. It's not just one thing in one place. It can do multiple things in multiple places all at once.
That is Greg Barton. He is a professor at Deakin University and chairman of the Department of Global Islamic Politics. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Also in the news, a new study is finding that cash transfers rather than food rations have greater impact on the refugees living in Rwanda. The study was conducted by the United Nations World Food Program and the University of California. Steve Taravella is the acting deputy director of the WFP here in Washington. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the significance of their findings.
Increasingly, humanitarian agencies are trying to demonstrate that our work is based in evidence, that we're not developing programs based on instinct or perceived need, but on actual need, and that we can use donor funds more wisely that way. So in this case, the big takeaway for us is that when humanitarian agencies that are delivering food, like the UN World Food Program, provide that assistance through cash mechanisms that enable beneficiaries to purchase their own food rather than us giving them actual food, the benefits go far beyond the way we improve the life of that individual or that family, but in fact affect the larger community in very positive ways. And for us in the UN, that's a really important finding because our work is all about strengthening communities. We want communities to be more resilient to all sorts of shocks, so to speak. The fact that there's increasing evidence, and this study from UC Davis and the International Food Policy Research Institute really adds a lot to that discussion.
How was the study performed and who was involved?
The University of California at Davis, the International Food Policy Research Institute, and the World Food Program collaborated on this study in three camps in Rwanda where Congolese refugees are living and receiving food assistance. And they used very scientific data analysis methods to look closely at the way food assistance was delivered, on the impact that it had on camps where food was delivered via cash mechanisms, which might not be actual cash. It could be e-cards, it could be vouchers, it could be money loaded onto cell phones, but a cash mechanism versus camps where Congolese refugees in Rwanda received actual food. Interviews were conducted also with vendors and members of the community to assess if, in fact, there was a real difference in impact. The researchers found that there was a significantly greater positive impact on the broader community, even those living outside the refugee camps, where food assistance was delivered by a cash mechanism rather than the actual delivery of food.
What are some examples of the economic impact regarding the benefits of the cash for refugees?
Well, I guess maybe the most persuasive is that, you know, we say that for every dollar's worth of food for refugees, it increases real income for the community by about $1.20 U.S. But in two of these three refugee camps where refugees were receiving cash transfers each month instead of in-kind food, Each dollar they received translated into ranging from $1.51 to $1.95 in the local economy. Well, that's almost double. That's really significant. It improves the lives of those in the community, of those doing business with the community, and certainly of those in the refugee camps who are our primary aim.
Going forth, then, how will these findings change the way you all do humanitarian assistance for refugees?
That's a good question. Increasingly, we are delivering food assistance where possible using these cash mechanisms. And this study confirms that we're on the right track in doing that. This year, WFP hopes to reach about 9.5 million people in 54 countries with almost $1 billion in transfer value of food assistance. That would be up from last year, where we transferred about $680 million in food assistance via cash. So we are moving in that direction. It is a significant part of our work. That said, I want to be clear for your audience that cash assistance for food isn't always the best answer. We still deliver in many settings actual food because many settings food isn't available in local markets, for instance, or emergency conditions don't enable us to provide cash assistance. So we assess every situation differently and decide what's the most efficient, the best for those people who are in need, the easiest for them to get food, and the most cost effective. And right now, in those settings where we've determined that cash is the most useful, it's just really reassuring to have scientific studies like this showing that that's in fact the case.
That's Steve Taravella. He is the acting deputy director of the World Food Program here in Washington. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. About a week after Britain voted to exit the European Union amid concerns about globalization, parallels are being drawn to the American voter sentiment during an increasingly contentious presidential campaign. VOA's Aru Pandey traveled to the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, once a major U.S. manufacturing hub, to get the residents' take on how large a role the U.S. should play in the global economy.
The air outside this factory in northeast Philadelphia once smelled of cookies, but the aroma, along with the 350 workers who for decades made Oreos, disappeared last year when snack food giant Mondelez shift production elsewhere. Across the street at Milovoy Auto Sales and Service, owner Art Milovoy recalls friends losing their jobs.
We see so many people unemployed, so many older people too in their 50s. That have lost their job. They're in their third or fourth job where our parents would have it for life, and they'd have a pension, and they'd have Social Security. We're not guaranteed any of this.
Milovoy, who runs auto body centers in and around Philadelphia, says he will likely consolidate his own business because of rising taxes and regulatory fees. He says the government should do more to support small businesses and keep American companies like Mondelez from shifting their operations to countries like Mexico.
NAFTA has allowed avenues for companies such as Mondelez to leave this country easily. And all the people that were promised jobs were scattered for a short time, but I understand that their other plants are shutting down in Chicago, etc.
Just 20 miles south along the Delaware River, the scene couldn't be more different as truckers pick up cargo containers on a busy Wednesday morning. Amid the hustle and bustle of factories and cargo ships lies Frank's Restaurant, serving up breakfast and lunch to truck drivers and longshoremen in Philadelphia since 1910. Owner Joe Trucino, whose father bought the place in 1966, says business has gone up and down with the economy over the years. Still, he's doing okay.
If I give a good product and I open my business on time every day and I'm here the hours I say I'm going to be here, people can depend on me, and if they know they can depend on me, they're going to be repeat customers.
Customer Kevin Kundla says nearly all the workers at his marine contracting company were laid off during the 2008 recession. Commerce Construction has since bounced back. Amid all the talk of Brexit and globalization, Kundla says the United States cannot afford to go it alone.
I don't believe the U.S. should isolate itself. It's a global economy. It's a global world. My son lives overseas, and I travel overseas to Southeast Asia, and I'm headed there in about 2 weeks.
This debate over trade and the U.S. role in the global economy will likely be amplified as American voters prepare to head to the polls in November. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Philadelphia.
And now we turn to what's happening on social media. Even though the two major U.S. political parties' candidates for president are virtually settled, there is lots trending about this election. My colleague G. Abby Lee is here with all the buzz. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. A tweet by presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump has been trending throughout the weekend. More precisely, it's about a tweet he deleted. On Saturday, Trump tweeted a meme and captioned it, "Crooked Hillary makes history." He has been calling his Democratic rival Crooked Hillary for some time, so the wording is nothing new. The issue here was with a meme. It showed a picture of her face and a Fox News poll that showed 58% of its respondents associating Clinton with the word corrupt. Now next to her face, it was written, "Most corrupt candidate ever." And now the real issue was with the shape of the graphic that surrounded those letters. It was a 6-pointed star, which some people found to be too reminiscent of the Star of David. I shared a screen grab of his original tweet on my Twitter page, at G Abby Lee, that's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. Dana Schwartz, who writes for The Observer, first tweeted the screen grab and wrote this, "What could Donald Trump possibly be evoking with the raining money and Star of David?" More than 1,300 people liked it so far. But of course, there are also those who say the shape of the star is just a shape and should not be interpreted as anything more than that.
Okay, now, you said the tweet is no longer, correct?
Yes and no. He replaced it with a new meme and a tweet. He tweeted the same, but added two new hashtags, hashtag I am with you and hashtag America first. The controversial 6-pointed star is replaced with a circle. The second hashtag, America First, is also stirring up quite a controversy online. It's a name of a movement led by an American pilot back in 1930s who sympathized with Nazi Germany. The Anti-Defamation League had previously asked Trump to refrain from using that specific phrase. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. As G just mentioned, she can be found on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency says its comet chasing Rosetta orbiter will wrap up its mission on September 30th. That's when the space agency will send the spacecraft on a controlled descent to the surface of its comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. ESA says the mission has to end because the spacecraft and the comet it's chasing are traveling too far from the sun, which is reducing the solar power needed to operate Rosetta and its instruments. Adding to the decision to terminate the mission is the plain fact that the spacecraft is pretty much getting near the end of its life, having to deal with the harsh environment of space for over 12 years, two of which was spent close to the dusty comet. As it drops to the surface of 67P during the final hours of its mission, Rosetta will capture some close-up images and make a number of what ESA calls once-in-a-lifetime measurements of the comet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Muad Subahi is a Yemeni artist who over the last 6 years has been running mural campaigns to beautify the streets of Sana'a, the nation's capital, and to express some daily concerns and issues. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us part of his job is to make sure he doesn't paint alone.
When the Arab Spring came to Yemen in 2011, protesters wanted to change the regime and bring their country into the modern era. Instead, the conflict and the revolution have brought more poverty, oppression, and devastation to millions of civilians. That suffering has been documented by artist Muad Subahi, who has launched 5 art campaigns over the past few years.
We want to convey the message about the economy, that there must be real solutions and stop corruption and the deterioration of the economy.
Yemen is currently embroiled in a civil war between the Shia Houthi people and the former government of Sunni leader Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, which is supported by a Saudi-led coalition and has received limited support from the United States. The conflict that started in 2015 is reflected in Subahi's current campaign, which is called Ruins. He says paintings on the walls of buildings that were damaged in the war serve as a memorial to the thousands of people who lost their lives in the conflict. Murals on many other walls stand as reminders of those who were kidnapped and disappeared.
Art, colors, and paintings is a totally peaceful call for Yemenis to refuse hatred and conflicts and move forward the construction of their country and stop the destruction. We are fed up with what we have today. The Yemenis are sick and tired of wars and conflicts.
Over the past 6 years, many young artists have joined this mural movement. Artist Subahi says he hopes these colorful murals will encourage his fellow Yemenis to start discussions and come up with solutions for a better, more peaceful future. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
As I mentioned earlier, the United States is celebrating its 240th birthday today, July 4th, also known as Independence Day. In front of the nation's capital, just outside our studio here in Washington, later today, one of the biggest celebrations ever will take place. Fireworks, entertainments, all kinds of things happening. International Edition's Lori London asked the show's executive producer, Michael Colbert, who will be on hand this year to entertain.
The legendary Smokey Robinson is coming to do some of his hits. We've always wanted Smokey. We've been doing the show for 36 years, and we got him. We're so excited. Allison Porter, who just won The Voice, is coming. She's going to sing the national anthem, as well as she's going to do something special. It's the 100th anniversary of our national parks. And Allison is going to be doing an amazing version of America the Beautiful that'll be intercut with some of the most beautiful footage you've ever seen of the parks throughout the United States. We're very excited that Christopher Jackson, who plays George Washington on the mega hit Hamilton on Broadway, is coming. We're so excited. So if you will, George Washington's coming back to Washington, D.C., right?
Very nice.
We're real excited about that. It's an Olympic year, as we all know, and Scott Hamilton is going to come and do a special tribute, a kickoff, really, if you will, to the Rio Games. And we have a couple of dozen members of Team USA are going to come and join us. And Cassidy Pope, who won the Voice a few years back and who's been a number one selling country artist, is doing her big hit, Invincible. And for the first time ever on Capitol 4th, General Colin Powell, a great American leader that we all know, is going to do a tribute to the 75th anniversary of the USO. And General Powell ran a USO center when he was stationed in Germany. And he's got a lot of great things to say about all of the good works that the USO does. And then Kenny Loggins is coming to get us all up doing Footloose. Amber Riley from Glee and The Wiz Live. Oh, she can blow the roof off the place. She's so much fun. And look out, we have the whole cast of Broadway's On Your Feet, the Gloria and Emilio Estefan story, are coming. And it's the biggest and best Fourth. The fireworks here are, there's nothing like them. They're so amazing, with the icons of the Washington Monument, the Lincoln, the Jefferson, the White House, and especially the West Lawn of the Capitol. We're live. We're going around the world on the American Forces Network for all of our troops. And, Lori, one last thing. For the first time ever, we're actually going to stream the show, and it'll be on Facebook and YouTube.
How many people are you expecting to attend this year?
There'll be hundreds of thousands, over 10 million viewing live on PBS. It's really, really something. No place like Washington, D.C. for our nation's birthday party.
That is Michael Colbert. He is executive producer of the annual Capitol Fourth U.S. Independence Day celebration. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Well, you know, it seems appropriate to end the program today with one of America's best singing one of America's best. Here's Ray Charles's version of America the Beautiful.
Oh, beautiful, for heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self their country loved, and mercy more than life.
Oh, my goodness, he knew how to do it, did he not? Huh? Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Now a bit more of Ray Charles. We hope everyone has a great Monday.
May God thy gold refine, tin for success, be nobleness and every gain divine. When I was in school, you know, we used to sing it something like this. Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Self-government, that is, a people exercising all the necessary functions of power without interference by a higher authority that they can't control themselves, is a core American value. It's also at the heart of the Declaration of Independence, which we celebrate today. Thomas Jefferson, the document's primary author, wrote that self-rule is the separate and equal station that a people are entitled to under the laws of God and nature. It didn't come easily. America's early history is marked by conflict with other countries threatened by republican government and among Americans themselves over the ultimate form that that government would take. But the Declaration laid the framework for a nation that would endure and grow, inspiring similar independence movements around the world. When war first broke out between Britain and its North American colonists, few imagined, let alone supported, the creation of a new nation. Historians note that even as the fighting raged, the colonists were deeply divided over the future. Roughly a third came to believe a complete break with Britain was needed. A third remained loyal to the British crown, and a third simply wanted to be left alone to raise their families and do their jobs. The 56 men who signed the Declaration on July 4, 1776, cast the first votes for independence. Their fellow citizens ratified the choice, and with it the then radical principle that government should be based on the consent of the governed. While this is the event and cause we celebrate today, it isn't unique to Americans. It is embodied in the constitutions of many nations and observed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we all recognize. In essence, then, Independence Day is a celebration of our common humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.